Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Untangled Resolutions presentation of The Breakup Whisperer. I am your host, Batabi Libntombeni, The Breakup Whisperer, and I'm coming to you from the southern tier of New York State in the United States of America. The convention about breakups is that they happen when being in the relationship is worse than not being in the relationship. There is blame, anger, acrimony, heartache, and regret. In fact, the prospect of going through all of that drives many people to stay in unhappy relationships. But can there be contentment, appreciation, understanding, even joy? Join me and my guest, Dr. Diane Killian, as we explore how nonviolent communication can transform your breakup experience. Our intro music is brought to us by the wonderful people at Purple Planet Music. That's www.purpleplanet.com. The tune you're listening to is called Cool Strutton. Sit back and listen while everyone gathers. We'll be with you in just a moment. Hello, everyone, and thank you so much for tuning in to The Breakup Whisperer. I am your host, Batabi Libntombeni, The Breakup Whisperer, and today we have a really special guest. We're talking with Diane Killian about nonviolent communication and how that can be useful to folks who are going through breakups. But before I get into that, you know, stuff happens, right? In the process of putting together the show and so forth, you can miss stuff. And I just noticed as I was listening to the intro with you that I mispronounced Dean's name. So my apologies to Dean. Dean, you are on the air. Thank you so much for joining us. And I don't know how that happened.
Well, first of all, thanks so much for having me on your show, Batabula. And, you know, having an unusual name, which I'm guessing you can maybe relate to as well, I'm used to that. So, and I think it's just, you know, obviously Diane's such a common name. It's, you know, it's easy for people to think of that. So I understand. And thank you for doing it.
Well, I appreciate you being so gracious. I've just never called you Diane in my life. I've known Dean for quite a number of years, and that's one of those slips that just is baffling to me. But I'm glad that you're here. Thank you for being so gracious. And how are you doing?
I'm doing really well. As you know, I just got back from a week in the Bahamas teaching there. So as some of my friends would say, life's rough when you have to go to places like that for work.
My heart bleeds for you. But I'm glad you had the opportunity to go.
Yes, and it was exciting to get to share nonviolent communication with a large group of people there.
Well, great. Thank you for bringing that up, because I do want to dive right in and talk about the core of why I've asked you to be on the show today, you know, how the principles of nonviolent communication can be applied to situations where people are going through breakups. And then I want to talk a little bit more about your practice and how you came into the field. And then we'll talk a bit about an event that you have coming up next week. But let's start with nonviolent communication. You know, I'm curious, and I'm sure a lot of people are curious, about what it means to have nonviolent communication. Most people, I think, when they're talking about violence, they are imagining physical violence. And, you know, somebody hitting somebody else or, you know, some other kind of physical harm happening. But what does it mean to communicate nonviolently?
Yeah, well, thank you for bringing up that point, Batabula. I think the name nonviolent communication can definitely be confusing for some people, but I'm sure as some listeners know, I'm happy to say, because Nonviolent Communication, or NVC, as it's often referred to as for short, has become more and more widely known in the last 10 or 20 years. The model was developed by Marshall Rosenberg, a psychologist, who worked very closely with Carl Rogers as a graduate student. So if you're a follower of Rogerian psychology, you can definitely see the influence there. But Marshall was also very much influenced by the 1960s and 70s and all of the social change movements going on at that time, and very much inspired by Gandhi and principles of nonviolence. So when he developed this model, while I think he could have called it many different things, you know, like deep listening or conscious listening, I like to call it collaborative communication because I think it ultimately fosters collaboration, especially in a workplace. Marshall called it nonviolent communication because, again, he was thinking of, you know, that translation of the Sanskrit word ahimsa, you know, as used in nonviolence, as in physical nonviolent civil disobedience, and this is the communication kind of version of it in Marshall's mind. So that's where the name came from, just to give some background, because that can be confusing. But, you know, Marshall often pointed out, he passed away a few years ago, but when he was teaching, he often pointed out that, you know, people think usually of violence only as physical violence, but in fact, our communication can be very, very violent. And, you know, I always found interesting that children's rhyme, you know, sticks and stones can break your bones, but words can never hurt you. Well, we all know that words can be very, very, very hurtful. And it's interesting, one of the interviews I did with Marshall, he talked about work he was doing with police in Israel. And they said to him, well, what do you do when someone has a gun? And Marshall was curious about this, and he went and, you know, the police there talked with them about all, like, recent incidents where that happened. And in every single incident, there had been at least one verbal exchange before a gun was taken out. So Marshall's point was, yes, obviously, you know, when it's at a point of physical violence, language has its limitations. But usually we don't get to a point of physical violence as human beings until there has been some breakdown in communication.
Until there has been some verbal violence.
Exactly. So there's definitely a connection, but again, when we hear the word violence, we tend to think only about physical violence, but, you know, I think there's many different forms of violence in our society. Obviously, physical violence, communication violence on, you know, how we speak to ourselves internally, intra-communication, intercommunication between two people, and then, you know, I would even consider societal violence, I mean, in terms of power structures, how they're set up, you know, on a very broad level, we could define violence as any situation where one person's needs are really not being met or held with care, and the other person is using their power for their needs to be met to kind of their own advantage without holding awareness of the other. I mean, that's kind of a very simple definition, but I think there's some accuracy to it.
Well, you're bringing up a couple of concepts that I'd like to delve in a little bit more deeply. We're going to talk about needs, definitely, in a minute. You know, needs met is the problem of unmet needs is very much central in nonviolent communication. But I wondered whether you could help out the folks who are, you know, coming to this and are very new to it by giving us some examples of what would be considered violent communication in the world of nonviolent communication.
Sure. You know, generally what we're aiming towards in practicing nonviolent communication is holding both parties' needs with care and communicating in a way that fosters connection. And I find when, as a trainer traveling the world, and I feel very grateful, for example, that several years I worked for the UN Development Program as a consultant leading training for their staff, so I had an opportunity to teach people all over the world. And I have yet to find anyone in any culture who enjoys being morally judged. What I mean by morally judged is, you know, Marshall Rosenberg made a distinction between discernment. Like, we all have a need to discern what's going to meet our needs. But that's different than morally judging somebody. The example Marshall gave is if you offer an apple to a dog, the dog will, you know, sniff that apple and just walk off. It's, you know, I've yet to see a dog. Maybe there's one somewhere that likes to eat apples. But the point is, the dog is not going to walk off thinking, what an idiot, what a jerk, she offered me an apple. The dog's just not interested in the apple. So the dog will discern what's going to meet his or her needs. but it's not going to have a moral judgment. So that's where human beings are quite different. Because what we do is if someone offers us something that we don't want or attempts to force something on us that we don't want or they do something we don't like, it very quickly often becomes about them and our judgment of them and what they did wrong or the kind of person they are or that they never listen or, you know, it's about the other person and it's a judgment, it's a generalization. So what we're doing in nonviolent communication is really taking responsibility for our own experience, our own feelings and needs. And first of all, that's empowering because at the end of the day, each of us ultimately is responsible for meeting our own needs or holding our own needs with care. But also, it's far more effective in communicating with other people when we can take out the judgment and the moral judgment and the blame and the demands and any shame or guilt. And just talk about what, you know, as Marshall called it, what would make our lives more wonderful, and invite the other person to participate in that and to see what would work for both parties. So that's basically what we're doing with nonviolent communication.
I see. So with nonviolent communication, then, you know, we're talking about distinguishing between moral judgment and discernment to begin with, and then focusing in on the judgment aspect of what makes certain communications to be violent. You know, I remember reading Marshall Rosenberg's book and being very finding it very illuminating to finally understand what is meant by violence in the context of nonviolent communication, that it stems from the judgment aspect, and that judgment then leads to blame, demands, guilt, and shame, as you mentioned. And then that those then lead to a desire for punishment. And therein is the violence, right?
Yes, exactly. I love how you make all those connections, Batabla, absolutely. And what's interesting is we tend to distort that chain of, you know, connections. You know, what happens is there is a stimulus, and we tend to confuse the stimulus as cause. And then
okay.
we blame the other person. In fact, there's a stimulus, then there's our thoughts about the stimulus, and then based on our thoughts about the stimulus, we have a reaction. Now, that's
okay.
actually very, very important, I think, to think through. I hope I'm making it clear. Like, for example, you know, the example I often give is if you have plans to meet someone for dinner, you know, here, I like this example because we, again, tend to think or can think, oh, the other person did this to me or they're wrong, but here's the ultimate test. Our responses can be different for the same stimulus. So to go back to my example, if you have plans to meet someone for dinner, and I'm sure we've all had this experience of a couple hours before, whatever it is, 3 hours before, an hour before, the person texts or emails and says, listen, I'm really sorry. I have this work project. It's taking longer than I thought. Can we reschedule? Now, I know from my own experience, sometimes it happens to me, and I'm relieved because I'm actually behind with work or really wasn't in the mood to go out that night. So I'm like, great, let's reschedule. So my thought there is, perfect, I'm also on a deadline. Now, if I have some story about this person, maybe this has happened once before, maybe it's someone that I'm romantically interested in, whatever that is, I could have a very different story about that. It's that story in my mind, my interpretation, that's actually going to create my reaction. You know, so whatever that story is, like, oh, she always does this, or, oh, I guess she doesn't like me. So it's not the stimulus. It's what we're telling ourselves about it that creates the reaction.
Got it. Okay. That's also something that I found to be really illuminating in Marshall's book. He gives a similar kind of example to illustrate how it isn't what the other person did, but what it means to you.
Yes.
That then engenders the reaction.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting to notice how many different responses people can have to a stimulus. One of the exercises I do often at workshops when I lead them is I'll have, you know, on different points of the room, a kind of visceral response, you know, like happy, scared, pleased, angry, and then I'll read some stimuli, and I'll ask participants to get up and actually walk closest to the word that describes how they're feeling in response to the stimulus. Now, some of them it can be expected. There's a majority of people that are having a certain response, And I can tell you pretty much with every stimulus, and I give some examples, there's some people that are having a very different response to it. So we know that as human beings, we can respond quite differently to the same stimulus. And again, why? Our filter. It's our past experience, what we're telling ourselves about ourselves and about other people. That's where that moral judgment comes in again.
Well, then what about the statement, you choose how you feel? What are your thoughts on that? I hear people starting to say that, and there is part of me that says, you know, that's just really facile. You know, it's a very easy way to throw back onto the person who is being impacted responsibility for what the acting person, you know, the person who has done whatever it is, who has created the stimulus, you know, to throw responsibility onto the other person and to absolve them for responsibility for their own contribution to the situation.
Yeah, well, I'm so glad you brought this up, Batavla, because this was like the sticking point for me when I first started learning nonviolent communication. It is for a lot of people. And it's because if we've had a certain amount of pain or frustration or disappointment in our lives and we're dealing with that pain, it can be very hard because we have a need for empathy. We have a need for understanding ourselves about how someone else's actions impacted our life. It can be very hard to see that as simply stimulus rather than cause. But to go back more specifically to your question, I think it's complex because all the research is showing 95 to 97% of our brains function on an unconscious level. And so much of our experience in the moment is influenced by past experiences that are not even conscious to us. This is where the question of choice becomes interesting. I ultimately believe we do have a choice. And I don't do it all the time. And sometimes, you know, one of the things I like to do is kind of a spiritual practice is if I'm unhappy with something, is just see if I can change my story. Because, again, it's the story that's actually leading to my emotional response. But, I hope I'm making this clear because I think there's some, complexity to it. But the point is, like, when you see people driving a car and there's road rage, a lot of stuff we see going on in the world, I don't think people are acting in a fully conscious way. Now, does that excuse their behavior? No. I believe, ultimately, we all need to take responsibility for our behavior. On the other hand, it's interesting how much research is coming out now about neurology that is showing, you know, for example, there's in this month of the Atlantic magazine, there's a very, very interesting article on psychopathy. And what the article focused on quite a bit was actually empathy, because that's the kind of contrast to psychopathic behavior. But the point I wanted to make is there's a bunch of people studying this now, and they have determined that 1% of the population is born without the neurological capacity for empathy. They can actually scan the brain, and they've identified the part of the brain where empathy resides. So it's not just learned behavior. It is a neurological genetic behavior. What's also interesting is that out of that 1% of people that are born without that gray matter that gives them that, what for most humans is our natural inborn capacity for empathy, 9/10 of those people will learn empathic skills by the time they're an adult because they learn it from other people. So the brain can develop and change. But what's interesting is there's one, if my math is accurate here, you know, 1/10 of 1% born without the neurological capacity for empathy, if for whatever reason do not learn those skills, probably because they're in a dysfunctional family environment where they're not having an opportunity to get compassion and care modeled to them. Mm-hmm. And it's that small percentage of people that the psychologists saying are largely responsible for violent crimes in the world because they lack empathy and they didn't learn it. But, you know, I'm just saying all this because, you know, choice does become complex in the context of the unconscious and neurology. And, of course, at the end of the day, I believe we do have a choice, and it's our responsibility, and often it takes a conscious effort. I know this as not only an NBC trainer, it's also a life coach, that people can make changes.
Right. Well,
some changes are harder to make than others, but we can make changes.
Right. So here's an example of how I've applied this in my own life. Prior to knowing about NVC or anything like that, I just knew that I was really annoyed and I was tired of being annoyed all the time, so I needed to make a change. So when I first moved to New York City and I lived in the city for about 13 years, I found myself becoming really, feeling really frustrated when I was either in traffic or walking down the street and, you know, you have all the cars that are stopped at a red light.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can sort of see a lot of the time when the opposite side that is green turns yellow and it's going to start to turn red. And
mm-hmm.
people in the line that was stopped, you know, on the side of the road that was stopped, would start honking before the light turned green for them. They were
mm-hmm.
already honking. And it drove
mm-hmm.
me bonkers because I'm like, what are they supposed to do? Why are you making all of this noise? The light is still red. Why are you honking?
Mm-hmm.
And so
I can see
why
that would be
frustrating. Right. So then I thought to myself, they're celebrating. They're celebrating that the light's going to turn green really soon. Yay.
It changed your story.
Exactly.
Yeah, and you know, what you also did, by the way, which is another, you know, core practice of nonviolent communication, is we can practice self-empathy, what we call self-empathy in NVC, which is connecting with our own feelings and needs, and we can also empathize with other people. So what you did, in my opinion, is you shifted from your own story and aggravation. You know, I'm guessing you're wanting patience, maybe wanting quiet and rest, you know, in the city with everything going on, a little less noise. And so you were focused on your needs and frustrated, and you then switched to guessing what they might be needing and what needs they could possibly be meeting by honking.
Right, exactly. Yes. That was it. That's exactly it. And I want to talk a little bit more deeply about empathy and about that switch and the power of that switch, particularly in the context of breakups. But before getting to that, I want to go back to the issue of violence, because there is then the opportunity to apply what we've been talking about in terms of understanding what makes communication violent in the context of breakups especially. There was that line that I talked about with you about how it starts off with moral judgment and then moves on then to a desire for punishment. That, you know, there's moral judgment. Moral judgment involves itself with blame, with demands, with guilt, with guilt, with shame, and then comes a demand for punishment. So in the context where people are going through a breakup, I think we all kind of know that this is a lot of what happens, right? When
yes.
there's a relationship ending, it's your fault.
Yes. And what's also interesting to me too, Batabla, is another certified trainer. We have a discussion list that all the certified trainers are on. And one of them a year or so ago made this comment that I loved. And he said he noticed him when he got irritated with his wife, that if he could pretend that it was the first time that she was doing it, he had way more space and patience. So, you know, here again is this classic example of, you know, the filter that we have. And, you know, we all know when we're first dating someone and speaking about, you know, chemistry and what's genetic is we've all those endorphins, you know, rushing through our veins. And so we have our kind of rose-colored glasses on a chemical, biological reality. But then also, you know, the first time it happens, it's like, you know, okay, you notice it bothers you a little bit, but you really like the person, you love. But once it's happened the 10th time and the 5th year, right, then we can start globalizing and making generalizations, like you always do that. And then it goes from you always do that to you just don't care, do you?
Mm-hmm.
So notice this pattern. We go from the first time, which was like, oh, that's kind of irritating, to then there's a pattern of, oh, this person's always doing that. And then we even globalize it more into, like, about their character and how they relate to us. And then we can also go into our own core stories, like, well, people never care. That's the story of my life. People never care, whatever our core story is. You know, so those are the ones that I especially like to look at and unpack and transform. They're the ones that take the biggest heavy lifting, in my opinion. But it's just so important because I want to be alive in the moment. And the more that I'm caught up in these old stories, I'm not in the present moment. And
but there are people who are...
opportunity.
Right, but there's those who are going to say, Well, this isn't about the past. I mean, they did it today. So
right.
How is it that about, you know, past experiences? You know, you're talking about living in the moment. Well, it's happening now in the moment, and it's been happening. You know, there's this pattern, and obviously, if they really cared about me, they would change. They wouldn't do this anymore. I mean, I've talked to them about it for umpteen times.
Right, yeah. And I mean, that's a really, I think, classic response, too, when we're frustrated and we want someone to change. And, you know, another line that I really like is that, you know, we have no control over other people's behavior, but every time we interact with them, we're educating them about how we want to be treated. And I think that's a really important key distinction, because what I see, you know, having worked with couples and also with organizations, by the way, you know, it's interesting. It's different, but not so different. As a consultant, I've supported numerous organizations where there's a staff person that really wasn't working out for them for various reasons, and they were having trouble letting them go. It's, you know, really not that different from when I've worked with couples in mediation or coaching where you know, one or both of them are heading towards wanting a divorce and they're having trouble letting go. You know, it's all the reasons you said in the introduction. You know, for the company, they've invested in the person. It's awkward to fire them. There can be legal issues. You know, just like in a personal relationship, you know, going through a divorce, there could be kids. There's a lot of reasons why you might want to stay together and trying to keep making it work. But at the end of the day, you know, as I said earlier, we are ultimately responsible for our own needs. So if someone is not acting in a way that we like and that we consider life-serving, we can't change them. You know, we can change our own behavior, and often there's changes in response to that. But if there's not the changes or results we want, you know, then it's up to us to take care of ourselves, and that often means stepping away or using some aspect of what we call nonviolent communication, protective use of force.
Protective use of force.
Yeah.
That is, wow. Okay, so that's actually coming out of left field for me because I haven't heard that term before. I want to know what that means, but we're going to take a moment here and take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to find out from Dean, we are going to find out from Dean, what is meant by protective use of force. What does happen when you finally decide that this relationship that you're in, and it's not necessarily romantic relationships, as Dean is pointing out, this can be applied to many different kinds of relationships, but when one comes to decide that the relationship is no longer life-serving, you know, how is it that one can use empathy and nonviolent communication to come that, to that decision and then to address it and actually act on the need to no longer be experiencing the violence in the relationship. So we'll be right back to discuss those things. You are listening to Untangled Resolution's presentation of The Breakup Whisperer, a show dedicated to promoting healthy breakup culture. Untangled Resolution's breakup coaching services can help you to figure out if you should break up, how to discuss breaking up, and how to nurture yourself after a breakup. Contact me, Batabile Mtombeni, The Breakup Whisperer, at welcome@123untangled.com. That's welcome@123untangled.com. Be sure to visit us on Facebook, like our page, and leave a note. Is there a topic you'd like us to cover? A guest you think would be great on the show? Please let us know. Facebook.com/123untangled. That's Facebook.com/123untangled. And now, let's get back to the show. Well, we are back on the show, and again, this is Batabile Mtombeni. This is The Breakup Whisperer, and you are on with, I am on with Dean Killian, who is a certified trainer in nonviolent communication and also a certified life coach, and we're talking about applying the principles, the philosophies of nonviolent communication to breakups. In relationships. And of course, on this show, we define relationship very broadly, and that can include an intimate relationship. It can include a friendship. It can include a job relationship. But, you know, how are we going to apply then the concepts of nonviolent communication to that arena. And we're still talking through some of the concepts of nonviolent communication. So just before we went to the break, Dean, you said something that is new for me, and I've been learning about nonviolent communication for a little while now, but I hadn't heard this before. And this was about proactive, what was it?
Oh, protective use of force.
Protective use of force. And I guess we're going to be talking about applying that in a situation where, you know, one has been in a relationship, has been trying to express their own needs and wants and to perhaps listen to the other person, although we haven't gotten into that yet because we haven't talked about empathy. But they've gotten to a point where they recognize that this relationship no longer serves their needs. So how does one come to that point? You know, we talked about how a person might be engaged in a behavior for, you know, a long period of time. You know, you've told them for the umpteenth time, this isn't working for me, that's not useful for me, they're not changing the behavior. We recognize that you cannot change another person. So what do you do in that situation?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm glad we're talking about this because my concern is that when people are sometimes learning nonviolent communication and they're feeling very excited and empowered with their new skills, that they sometimes can have this idea that no matter how challenging things are in a relationship, that they, quote, should be able to resolve it with their skills in nonviolent communication. So I just want to point out that should is another demand. It's another evaluation. It's easy for us to slip into those. What I rather look at is how can we hold our needs with care and the other person's needs with care. And if someone is acting in a way that I consider violent or abusive, verbally, emotionally, psychologically, or even physically, it is a contribution for both parties, for the person who is experiencing that violence to, if they are unable to change the circumstance, what's going on, to protect themselves. And I actually think it's a contribution for both parties to step away. You know, sometimes depending, you know, I gave quite a range there from emotional, verbal, you know, psychological to physical violence. But, you know, sometimes it's a temporary break. But, you know, sometimes it may be longer than temporary. You know, there is someone in my family who I found very, very challenging. Other people, by the way, my family have as well, too. And I dialogue with the person. I let them know what my concerns were. And basically the family member said, you know, well, that's the way I am. I'm not going to change. You just have to deal with it. And I realized it was having a huge impact on my life and my energy and my own self-esteem. So it's really hard to say, I'm never going to talk to you again. You know, by the way, in nonviolent communication, we also talk about doable requests. So, you know, I'm never going to talk to you again is one that I would consider not doable. Instead, what I said to this person is, you know, I think I want to take a break for 3 months because I'm hearing you say that you are how you are, and I can understand that you want acceptance of that, and I'm just unwilling to put myself in danger again of being on the receiving end of some of the things that I've heard you say to me over the years, some of your behavior, and I just need a rest right now, and I did, actually, just to kind of regroup. And, you know, that 3 months, I decided to do another 3 months, because it actually really worked for me. But it was a lot easier also. I think it's very hard, especially if someone's important to us in our lives, like it's an intimate relationship also, to say, oh, this is it. I'm just never going to, you know, we're breaking off for good. I mean, that makes it really hard to break up also. So to be able to say, you know something, let's try taking a break for 3 months. Sometimes the 3 months is enough or whatever that period is. So I just wanted to give that as an example of a breakup, even within a family, not just someone that you're dating, a breakup meaning to put a pause or break up relations with someone. But if that's clear, Bataba, what I'd like to do is give a more concrete example of protective use of force. But do you have any questions about what I just covered? Because we're covering a lot. We're going at a really...
I know.
We're here covering a lot of
things. Right. I want to encourage anybody who's listening to check out Marshall Rosenberg's book, Nonviolent Communication. And there's a workbook that is a companion to that also goes along with it that can also be very helpful. We are taking what can take months, if not years, for people to really learn thoroughly and sort of dipping in a little bit here and a little bit there. And I think that's useful to at least present the concepts so that folks can then go and delve more deeply for themselves. But yes, you're right, Dean. We are getting into some really advanced topics really quickly in nonviolent communication. I wonder, would it be useful for us to talk about empathy before talking about preventive use
protective
of force?
And by the way, since you're mentioning books, I just want to give a shout out for two books that I've co-written. I co-wrote with Jane Connor called Connecting Across Differences. And it's a combined book and workbook, and people say it's one of the most, you know, thorough and detailed explanations and description of nonviolent communication. And like I said, it's combined book and workbook, so you can read and do some exercises. And then there's another book that I wrote and someone else illustrated called Urban Empathy, True Life Adventures of Compassion on the Streets of New York. So both of those... both of those books, I think, might be helpful to listeners as well. So
Certainly.
I think what you're asking is, what is empathy?
What is empathy?
Yeah. So, you know, we could look at dictionary definitions of empathy as distinct from compassion or sympathy, because those three can often be confused, in my opinion. But what I really want to focus on is what we mean by empathy in nonviolent communication, because it's a very, very specific practice. What we're doing when listening empathically in nonviolent communication is we're listening for what I call, in colloquial speech, someone's visceral response, not their, you know, kind of, you know, their visceral response on a physical somatic level and on a feeling level. You know, so are you tensing up when you hear that? Are you feeling anxious? Are you feeling sad? Are you feeling disappointed? So what is your somatic, your felt sense and emotional visceral response when you hear or see the stimulus? And then what are you needing? Now, in English, it's easy to say things like, I need a new car, I need a new girlfriend, I need a house, I need a new notebook, or whatever it is that we think we need on a material item, or also could be a behavior like, I need to brush my teeth 3 times a day, or I need to exercise more. All of those are what we would call a nonviolent communication strategies. They are particular. Oh, go ahead.
They're strategies, they're not needs.
Right. What we mean by needs in this model is universal qualities that all people, regardless of their culture, need. Now, those needs are met in many, many different ways. But to give you an idea, like all human beings all over the planet, in my experience, again, several years having taught with UNDP and even like being based in New York City, getting to work with people here, regardless of the UN from all over the world, I find that these values are universal. You know, they include qualities, for example, like respect, choice, community, compassion, empathy, accountability, consistency. So how we meet those needs, and by the way, those are just a few examples. If you go to my website, which is www.workcollaboratively.com, or the international website, cnbc.org, you can download a list of feelings and needs that we use in practicing the model. But what's interesting to me is people, you know, have all of these needs around the world, but we meet them in very, very different ways. So, you know, one example I like to give is in American culture, we indicate respect by making eye contact. I would say that's generally true in the West, I believe. In other cultures, you show respect by looking down. So it's the same need, but it's a very different strategy.
And Dean, can I tell you that one has been the bane of my existence, especially when I was a kid, because I was born into a culture where one does not make eye contact and shows respect by looking down or looking away, and then was raised in a culture where one shows respect by keeping eye contact. And it just drove me bonkers because, you know, if I'm at school, my teacher's saying, look at me when I talk to you. And if I'm at home, it's, are you looking at me?
Wow. Well, I'm like really appreciating, Batabla, how just like confusing and frustrating that must have been.
There was also some humor behind it as well. You know, I mean, one learns to be flexible, you know, especially if you're living in a multicultural community. you know, one learns that in this context, this is what is polite. In that context, that is what is polite, and so forth. And so I appreciate that I was sort of forced in a way by circumstances to learn how to be flexible in different cultural contexts, and it has served me well. But it was, you know, for some periods of time, like, what do you do?
Yeah. And by the way, if listeners didn't notice, I was just empathizing with you.
Yes, you were.
I don't think I got to my knees, but, you know, I was saying, wow, I can really appreciate that. That could be very confusing, very frustrating, probably even exhausting, like just having to, like, pay attention to that. And I'm guessing some of the needs up for you is probably simply wanting ease.
Well, sure.
Understanding.
Well, but then I came back in, and this is great because we're modeling now, right? What happened is that I came back in to clarify that what you were suggesting as needs for me really didn't describe what I felt in terms of needs. And so in that clarification, then there's an opportunity for you as a listener to revise your understanding of what I'm expressing in terms of needs.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, even though I'm making a guess, you know, you can, it's just a guess. And it's just really an effort towards connection. So you can let me know, you know, or whoever I'm making the empathy guess to can let me know if that actually is matching their experience.
And so then in the process of giving empathy, we can get back then into you know, expanding on understanding what empathy means specifically in the nonviolent communication context, in the NVC context. You know, in that process, then you are then building connections, right?
Yeah, that's the main focus. It's about
okay. Right. So we were talking then about defining empathy, and you were talking about universal needs. You were giving examples of ways of expressing respect, for example. You were saying in some cultures, you know, the strategy for addressing the need for respect is to look down or to look away. And in other cultures, the strategy for expressing respect is to hold eye contact, right? But that what is universal is this need for respect.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, we could give many, many other examples of this. One of my other favorite examples is around food. You know, obviously, I think pretty much all of us as human beings enjoy eating. We need to eat to survive. We like to eat. But, you know, one person will like one kind of food and one person likes spicy and one doesn't. We all have a need for food and enjoyment and pleasure in eating. But what we'll actually meet our needs will be different. So that's just another handy example of a strategy as distinct from a need.
Right. So then you were also saying when listening to somebody and wanting to give empathy, you know, one is focusing for needs and then also for visceral reactions. You know, are you feeling tense perhaps, you know, uncomfortable in a different way? Tell me a little bit more about what that means.
I'm sorry, can you repeat the first part of the question? I missed that.
Sure. So we were talking about empathy, you know, there's in nonviolent communication, there's the verbal awareness of verbal communication. You know,
right.
I, for example, said to you, you know, this is my story. And you then made empathy guesses.
Yes.
By saying, well, you know, I appreciate that perhaps you had a need for ease and that this experience may have been frustrating for you. But then there's also the visceral aspect of it. You know, you had started to talk about physical reactions and being aware of physical reactions.
Yes, I really like to bring somatic awareness into the practice of nonviolent communication. And I think many other trainers are also increasingly doing that as well. You know, traditionally there's four steps to the practice of NVC or nonviolent communication. The first step is noticing what you're seeing or hearing, what your observation is, free of evaluation, which, by the way, can be much harder than people realize at first because we tend to believe that our judgments are true. So, you know, quick example around that, if you say, like, oh, you're late again, to most people or many people, that could sound like an observation. Oh, they're late. But really what the observation is the backstory that's leading us to think that the person is late, which would probably sound something like, oh, my understanding is we were meeting at 6 and you've arrived now and it's 6:20 and this is the second time that's happened when we've met in the last few weeks.
So that's an observation.
An observation. So that's the first step in the model. Second step is to identify what you're feeling or the other person is feeling. And that step we want to be free of judgment. And there's quite a few words in English that we use as if they are feeling words, and they actually are judgment words. Like, for example, I feel misunderstood or I feel disrespected. What those words actually mean is you're not listening to me and you do not respect me. That's different than a feeling, an actual feeling word, like I'm sad, I'm hurt, I'm disappointed, I'm scared, I'm angry, I'm delighted, I'm relieved, etc. So that's really important for the second step. The third step is identifying what I'm needing and or the other person is needing. As we spoke about earlier, for that step, we want it to be free of strategy. We will get to strategies eventually, and it's much easier for the other party to hear us and to come up with solutions that work for everybody if we first focus on the core needs at play. So I gave some examples of those core needs earlier, words like community, choice, autonomy, respect, harmony, rest, physical well-being. So there's about 200 or 300 feeling needs words and feeling words on the list that you can download from my site in CNBC. So that is the third step. And the fourth step is to make a request. And we practice different kinds of requests in NBC. Most of the time we're practicing what we call connection requests, which is simply making sure you're understanding the other person, you're on the same page, what is going on for them. And once you really have connection, then moving on to what we call a clear, positive, doable request. So those are the four basic steps. In a nutshell, crash course there. I forgot that. I know I was going there from somewhere, but can you remind me again of feeling a little sheepish?
Right.
Question was before, for a reason.
So then we were talking then about the somatic aspect of things, bringing somatic awareness.
Yeah, so the somatic step, in effect, you know, I consider it as a pre-step for the feelings, or you could just consider it as part of step two. So rather than just looking at your emotional response, also looking at your felt sense response. And here's the thing, I've developed a practice based on nonviolent communication called somatic-based empathy. And so I find this very fascinating about how to communicate with the body. What I wanted to say, the thing is, our bodies communicate to us through physical sensation. If you think about it, if we're cold, our body cannot say, hey, Dean, it's a little cold in here. You know, we have a physical sensation that tells us that we're cold. We come to learn. Part of what growing up and becoming an adult is learning what our bodies are telling us, when we're hungry, when we're thirsty, when we need rest, when we need to go to the toilet, when we're sick, you know, whatever that is, our bodies are communicating to us about its needs. I find it really fascinating. And if we can start paying closer attention to our physical sensations, we can learn a lot more about ourselves and have a lot more awareness and choice, in my experience. Because what will happen is many of us are in our heads in Western culture, and I think increasingly the whole world, not connected to our bodies. So I find a lot when I'm working with people, when they're triggered, they don't even realize that they're angry until they're really angry, until they're at a point where it's like someone like, you know, who's eating, and they don't realize until 20 minutes later they're uncomfortably full. You know, it's the same thing with a reaction. They're actually getting impatient. They're getting irritated. But they don't realize it until it's so big that it's kind of an explosion. If we can notice sooner and pay attention, are we retracting a little bit? Are we cringing? Are we pulling back? Those are important things to notice. Our bodies, it's so interesting. Our bodies even tell us when we don't like something.
Right, or someone, perhaps.
Yeah, and which is really helpful, by the way, on this breakup topic, right? Because we can run circles around ourselves and our thinking. Oh, he didn't mean it. Oh, but we have so many things in common. Oh, you know, our friends will be so disappointed. I mean, you could tell yourself things all day or all week, all month, so the cows come home. How do you actually feel when you are in the presence of that person? How do you feel about yourself? How happy do you feel? What is your visceral somatic response? I think it is so important to pay attention to what our bodies are telling us. Because often it's giving us a very clear message. And, you know, I'm not saying, you know, oh, your body says this, do this. But, you know, I also want to bring in my cognitive, rational mind. But it's hugely helpful information.
And we happen to be in a culture, particularly in the United States, that encourages strongly to suppress that, you know, to not to pay attention to those things and to emotions and so forth. But I want to take then the four steps. You outlined them so wonderfully clearly, and the somatic aspect of things, and go back to that breakup that you described with the relative.
Okay.
Because in the story, in the telling of the story, you actually described following the steps. But, you know, in the first listing, for folks who are very unfamiliar with NBC, they probably didn't hear it. So here's an opportunity to take the steps and go back and tell us, what did you do in the story that followed those steps?
Sure. Well, first of all, I gave an observation to the person, and this was some years ago, so I could try to imagine, you know, still having a memory of my interactions with this family member. But, you know, I wouldn't have it exactly right now. But, you know, basically I pointed out to this person things that I had heard them say, how they were interacting with me, and let them know that that's the observation, and let them know that, you know, again, I don't remember the exact feelings now, but that I was unhappy, frustrated, concerned about these behaviors. And, you know, wanting harmony for the two of us and ease and also, you know, self-care. You know, it's, again, it's up to me to take care of myself. Am I willing to put myself in harm's way? You know, I often talk to people when I'm trying to teach them about compassion and what it looks like to have empathy for yourself, which, by the way, I find so many of us are needing. We can be so hard on ourselves. Me included, too. I'm always reminding myself, too. But my point is, you know, I ask people, how would you talk to a young child that you care about as a caring adult? Imagine there's a 5-year-old here. What would you say to the 5-year-old about this situation? We usually talk to ourselves in way worse ways than we would talk to an actual 5-year-old that we care about. But I'm mentioning that in this context because, you know, if I saw someone else in this environment, what I was experiencing with this relative, like, you know, the level of language and you know, volume and judgment and, you know, exhausting, you know, I would want to protect that person. I would want to take them out of that situation. So why wouldn't I do that for myself as an adult?
Right.
And I think that's
right.
A really helpful thing for people to consider, since the topic of their focus of the show is breakups. You know, again, I'm not saying you're happy every single second with somebody. I don't think that's possible. We all have our differences at moments and moments of disconnection. But overall, 80-90% of the time in the last week or few weeks, have you enjoyed this person's company? Are you feeling happy and relaxed with them? Do you feel safe physically and secure emotionally? What is your visceral response around being with them? Those are important signs. And if the person is saying and doing things that's leading you to be stressed, restricted, pulling back, anxious, that is worth looking at, in my opinion. And again, the question is, if you saw someone else in that situation and you cared about them, what would you say? What would you do? I think that's
right,
a really litmus test.
Absolutely. And, you know, Dean, it's a little unfair. We're coming down to the last 5 minutes of the show, if you can believe that. This has gone by so quickly, but I don't want us to miss out on the protective use of force.
Okay, yeah, I was wondering if we would get back to that. You know, the example I wanted to give is, and this is a nice contrast about moral judgment and discernment as well, is if there's a young child, you know, say 2 or 3 years old, who is, you know, playing outside and running into the street and there's traffic. You know, the example of what I would call violent care would be, you know, to physically hit the child. I'm not recommending this. I'm giving it as a contrast. Physically hit the child and say, bad boy, you never listen to mommy, and, you know, and other judgments, whack, whack, whack. I told you not to go in the street, and then to go back in the house, worst case scenario, and still leave the child there. Protective use of force, in contrast, would be to pick the child up and say, and letting them know what's happening. I'm picking you up right now, and I'm putting you in the backyard where there's a fence because I'm concerned about you playing out here because I see the amount of traffic in the street. And I want confidence that you're going to be safe because I care about you.
And you've just gone down the list.
Yep.
You made the observation.
Mm-hmm.
You expressed the feeling.
Yep.
You expressed a need. And you expressed, well, in this case, it's not so much an offer, but you talked about a strategy,
kind of
a solution.
Request.
What do you call it? A request, yes.
It's a kind of a request in the sense that you're not asking the person, but you're letting them know what's happening and why.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that is different with protective use of force. It's one of the few examples don't dialogue because we make a choice based on our desire of, you know, and it's a high level practice. You really want to check with yourself: are you doing this in a compassionate way, out of care and consideration for the other person? I mean, another example, which I have done, by the way, with a friend, is, you know, if you're out with someone and you see they've had 4 or 5 drinks or whatever the number is, and you can tell that they're intoxicated, to say, hey, you know something, I see you're heading home, and I also saw you had a few drinks. I'm concerned. I care about you. So I'm taking your keys. I'm going to drive you home. And I did.
Uh-huh. Okay.
That's another example of protective use of force.
So then in the context of a breakup, I'm thinking that it can work where, you know, one is not making a request, which is what would happen in a different context in the form of nonviolent communication, but that you're saying, and I'm going to make this decision that it is safer, healthier, you know, whatever it is, for us to no longer share in this particular kind of relationship. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, and, you know, I think the only aspect of that I want to tweak is rather than saying no longer, because as like I said earlier with this relative, if I had said no longer, I think I would probably never have taken a break because that just is so hard to say and do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who wants, you know, so again, I, you know, as a coach and a trainer, I recommend people take small steps. Because they're easier.
Mm-hmm.
So rather, you know, well, you know, by the way, sometimes you want to break up. That's a clean break. Great, do it. But if you're struggling, say to the person, you know something, I'm just letting you know I'm taking a month break. And I'm not going to call you, and I'm going to ask you not to call me. And I want, you know, if you call me, I'm not going to pick up because I really do need and want this rest and just to kind of clear my thoughts. And see how we're feeling a month from now.
Okay.
And that's much more doable. If even a week, if a month feels too much, try it for a week. Then you'll see how you're feeling, how you feel when you have a break from that person.
And then you may feel more confident about making a decision one way or the other. Dean, thank you so very much for coming on the show. I'm probably going to have to ask you to come back because we did cover quite a bit of ground from a surface level, and it would be nice to be able to go more deeply. I want you quickly to let people know about the workshop that you're giving next week.
Yep, and it's at Cornell University, but some seats are open to the public. And we do have a few seats left, and it's limited to just 30 people. And it's a program that has proven really, really popular. I've offered it a few times, and it's called Getting Things Done, How to Get Results with Difficult People and Situations. And it's a two-day immersion in nonviolent communication. And you can go to workcollaboratively.com to learn more and to register.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Next week, Almarina Wade comes on the show to talk about breaking up with the demons of trauma. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today. Have a wonderful week. Bye-bye for now.